Welcome to the party, pal!
I love that movie.
It's Die Hard.
Get the kayak on the bucket!
Hey, Applauders. Thanks for sticking around. It's December. I'm Naomi McQuaid.
And I'm Lydia Malcolm.
You've waited for it, and it's here. And I hope you're ready for it, because we're about to talk about Die Hard.
The Christmas movie.
That's when I put in the bells and I'd be like... I
would think you would want to go for the creepy Christmas bells, that really ominous, you know, jingling of bells at the beginning.
The monotone bell ringing.
It's kind of out of place, but yet it fits so well.
Where you feel like you have to put all your change in the Salvation Army bucket, even though you're dubious about their charity work.
Because you're worried that they might, like, pull a gun on you?
No, I'm worried that they're going to, like, defame gay people and, like, work against persons that I love. Please research your charities before you give this holiday season. It's very important. There's lots of organizations that will help you look at their giving behaviors and that you should take into account just how much money goes to the causes that you care about and perhaps the money that goes to causes that you are very adamantly against.
Yeah, here we are a progressive podcast. Maybe that's getting too political.
No, I don't think it's too political. Yeah. I think we're for applauding people and being shocked at crappy behavior.
I'll get on board with that. Research is the best thing you can do for yourself and for your loved ones. Researching not just food, but, you know, where you put your money into and being mindful of that sort of stuff. And also research your own behavior because that's how you change. That's so awkward.
No,
I'm sorry.
I don't think it's terrible. I think you're right. I think that persons who responsibly donate will look into the organizations they give to. We are merely stating that near universally known Salvation Army uses a tactic of a compelling monotone jingle bell to compel you to put money that you weren't expecting to into a small red vessel outside of many convenience stores and shopping locations. So as I say Die Hard and you hear, I hope your gut gets tight and you feel like, oh no, some stuff is about to happen to Bruce Willis.
I don't know how much this has to do with Die Hard, but we're going to make it work. We're going to make it work.
There are bells in this movie.
Yes. Okay. So what was our format? I think it was what brought you to this movie. Like, what was your first experience with this movie?
Oh, my goodness. It's from before I can remember. I was 5 when it came out, give or take.
I think we did the math. It was you were 5.
And I mean, it's always existed. But until name drop Madeline was like, I'm going to watch Die Hard because it's December. And I was like, okay, I guess I'll watch that. Two. I didn't have it like in my repertoire. I wouldn't say I was an action fan. I've always liked Jackie Chan with my dad, and I've always liked the action parts of horror films has always been really fun. Like, but I wouldn't say I'm not as much as I kind of wanted to bond with some people over some Bourne movies. Like, it just hasn't happened. I'm not a Bond person.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I'm not much into action films myself, but I am grateful that I saw this movie because I found it delightful. Also, Alan motherfucking Rickman.
Okay, so yes, Alan Rickman, and we will come back to him
several times.
Again and again and again.
Several times.
Just without shame, we will keep talking about Alan Rickman. But that you hadn't seen this movie before we set up our schedule of the movies that we're going to bring to you, Applauders. I was surprised. Like, I think it was part of like the top 400 essential movies of something, something study.
Right.
So like, it's on so many lists and it's won several awards, so that you get to come to it so fresh and I get to come to it anew. I'm kind of excited to see how this pans out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, which pans out is not the connection to Pan's Labyrinth, which was our last one, which we're trying to do.
So connection from movie to movie. I was so excited between the first and the second, and the second and the third, but now the third and the fourth film that we're covering, I was completely stumped. I'm staring at the wall, like scratching my head. No idea.
Do you remember how you got about a certain Pedro from Pan's Labyrinth?
Oh, Pedro. Pedro points?
Pedro points? For me, Alan Rickman is my Pedro.
Oh.
That was the connection I made because I was just like gushing over him on every level. I was like, oh, he's holding a walkie-talkie. I want to be that walkie-talkie. Oh, he's looking at a vault. I want to be that vault. Oh, he forcefully grabs a woman so he can take her as a hostage. I think I'm down with that. I got issues.
That you would want to be any sentient or like
inanimate object. Hey,
I want to be literally anything within Alan Rickman's gaze.
That was kind of how I felt throughout this entire film. And like, he's not the biggest douchebag in this movie.
No.
We had a list of douchebags.
Running tally of people who are like the king of the D-bags.
Yeah, and he was not on it at all, because despite the fact that he is the bad guy, Hans Gruber, he's still kind of supportive of his people. He calms them down. He recognizes when the hostages need things that are legit. And he accommodates, but not in like a kind of a pushover way. He's a better negotiator than Coquette Harry, which I'm jumping ahead, which is what I do. I'm jumping ahead.
That's okay. We're going to call it back. Bring it forward. This has got to span several episodes just to draw out listenership.
Also, maybe this is why I just kept bringing up everybody had bedroom eyes, because I had bedroom eyes.
You just gazed upon Alan Rickman. Your eyes went watery and like an anime character. Your cheeks flushed and your hair twitched a little bit. And you were just like, you made those small Japanese anime noises that are just like,
You need to go to Los Angeles and become a voice actor. Like, I would just think that's like the greatest thing.
The saddest part of my life is my voice isn't high pitched enough to do a girl anime voice. Yamada-chan. Yamada-chan, I made you these white tea cookies. It's the shame of my existence, Lydia. And thanks for bringing it up.
Whoa. I'm not trying to shame you. I just think you have enough charisma to go ahead and bullshit your way through acting. Oh my goodness. I'm like, I am not an actor. I don't think I've ever really been that good at acting.
I think that you downplay yourself and your service, but I would like to point out that the way I get through most situations is bullshit. So if I were to be an actor, that would just be the natural course of things.
For me, it's just having like such a high level of anxiety. As soon as I step into a room, I'm noticing like everybody who looks slightly suspicious, and it's all like just do. It's like a grid. I'm like the Terminator. Just have this grid over my face. And I'm like, that's an exit. I can use that if I need to.
In my head, you were zeroing in on people and being like, zero threat. Guy between me and the bag of chips. Workplace associate I must say hello to before I exit this place.
It is also kind of like that. You know, what was it? There was a Community episode where Abed was trying to like go around and give like sick burns to some of the other girls. And then he had to like turn his powers on the girls in the group, in the study group. And it was like, there was like this whole like sheen. Whenever you would see his point of view, there would be like this grid. And like, he would like notice little things that he had to go ahead and yeah, it was great. I relate to that character in a lot of ways.
That is just like the best community character that there is.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. I think we were talking about Die Hard at one point.
And we might get back to it eventually, but I have several more points about my own personal life experience that I'd like to... No, we're jumping into it. You're on a plane. There's a nice middle-aged looking gentleman smiling at his armrest clenching seatmate, who is John McClane. Yeah. He asks him about being an awkward flyer, and he's a cop with 11 or 12 years of experience on the force, like, but planes make him uneasy, which, you know, I'm not trying to ask you to sequester your fears between, you know, putting your life on the line and being up in the air with God, but this fellow passenger, he says like the most awkward thing that turns out to be a very important plot point. He's like, hey, once you get on the ground, what you got to do is you got to take your shoes and your socks off, and you got to walk around making fists with your toes in the carpet to calm yourself down, to bring yourself back down to earth.
And McClane looks suspicious. Like, what is this? It's like any normal interaction with a person you don't really know.
If you've seen Get Me to the Greek, though, they've got that fuzzy wall thing for when people get too high or whatever, and it's a carpeted wall I don't know if you've seen Get Me to the Greek. No. You don't have to, but if you have seen it, then you'll remember there's a fuzzy wall that people would go and like hug when they were too messed up, and it would center them and bring them back down from a bad trip. So that's all I thought about when he was like, grip the carpet with your toes. I'm just like, fuzzy. I think there's a song. There might be a song that Russell Brand and, what's his name? Jonah Hill?
Mm-hmm.
Sing. Don't remember that all the way. It's not important.
Yeah.
They cut back and forth between the plane and the airport and what I have dubbed the evil office party.
Evil office party?
It's not really, but like just anything that takes place in the Nakatomi Tower, I feel like nothing good's going to come out of it. Like it's all dark lit. It's all like people talking low and like behind the big flash of the party. There,
this is a financial institution. You see at one point a character who we have dubbed Cokehead Harry.
Yep.
He is obviously trying to, he like does cocaine and he goes through
I do cocaine.
Sorry, I thought we were just like,
are you a Death Clock fan?
No.
I got some for you to watch, okay. Because there's the Dr. Roxo is this comedy clown who's like a spoof on Juggalos who just walks around and is just like, I do cocaine!
My name is Dr. Roxo, and I do cocaine!
Oh, God.
I was just looking at your face and I was like, are we like, is this like ranting? Like, should I not be saying this?
Nope, you're okay. Perfect. You're perfect. But anyway, so crackhead.
Cokehead.
So he's in a very prestigious position at this tower.
Mm-hmm.
He can afford cocaine.
You can tell because of the shoulder pads.
Yeah, his suit. Can I say, the longer you stare at Harry's suit, the more you're like, oh, there are blue. It's a pinstripe suit. He's supposed to be so hardcore. And then I'm like, oh, are there blue stripes in it? And then like he turns the corner and like gets a light flare on him. And I'm like, there are freaking red stripes in it. How 80s is this freaking suit?
I'm glad you noticed that. It just looked like a black suit to me.
No, it's got blue and red stripes and it looks like total doesn't look,
you know, if it had green and red, it would have been more Christmassy. I mean, this movie is very much a Christmas movie.
You know, you could also classically go with red and white for Christmas.
Yeah.
But he snorted all the white lines.
Yeah, da-da-da-da-da.
These are the jokes, folks.
This is what you came for. High quality content.
Cokehead Harry follows Holly Gerano McLean, played by Bonnie Bedelina.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she's at the party and she's like, I got some work to do. And she's got a phone call she's got to make. So she's rounding the office, right? And I was watching it. She takes like a right turn. Okay, she leaves the party into the hallway. She takes a right turn. He's talking his face off because he's stupid and can't not talk. And she's just like brushing him off with side talk. And she takes another right turn. And then she takes another right turn. And they end up back at the party. She takes another right turn. And then she's in her office. And I'm wondering if you can do four right turns, pass through the area you've been through before. I mean, anybody who's played Doom, could you please help me with this? You've gone four right turns and ended up through an area you've been through before and now are where you want to be.
So it kind of looks like she started at point A and trying to get to point B, but point A and point B are right next to each other from what you're seeing.
Yeah, but she had to like do this big dog leg around the whole thing. I don't know why that irritated me so much.
Yeah, it does kind of show like the party and you see things from her perspective, but it's a weird perspective. Yeah. Like, cause it's like right behind her.
Yeah, they're trying to establish like her businessy stuff, but then we get into the phone call and I call that troubled family time with Paulina. So she calls home and Lucy McLean answers, played by Taylor Fry, who is the cutest little girl I've ever seen. And I've seen several. And she's just like, McLean residence, Lucy speaking. And so cute. Oh my gosh.
Well articulated for like a 6-year-old.
Mm-hmm. And then her mom says hi. And then she hands the phone over to Paulina. And she's like, has John called?
No, Mrs. McLean. No telefono. So sorry.
I'm sorry, but because the IMDb page goes to, you know, it takes the time to tell you that this is played by an Italian actress.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see why she had to be Hispanic, but I mean, she does it perfectly, but she's very timid.
Well, what stuck out for me with Paulina is that when Holly, you know, asks, is Mr. McLean called? Paulina says, no, she hasn't. And Holly says, well, if you could just make up the extra room just in case he does want a place to stay, that would be great. And Paulina's like, already done. Go, Paulina. You recognized, when a marriage needed help.
Preach it.
And you went ahead and took extra steps to take care of that because you are amazing.
Yeah. They wouldn't be dragging this out for 6 months, Paulina, unless they really didn't want to let it go.
You are the best marriage counselor.
Paulina.
Paulina.
So now we cut to McLean gets picked up at the airport by a man holding a sign that says Jay McLean on it. And this is my friend, the love of my movie. Short of, like, okay, please note that my Alan Rickman thing is aside and elevated and on a pedestal.
Yeah.
But in this movie, if you had to pick somebody to hang out with, it's going to be Argyle, the limo driver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. He's really charming. He's nervous. This is his first time doing a limo thing.
He was a taxi driver, but now he's driving a limo.
And you know what? McLean, he's never been picked up by a limo at all. So he doesn't know what's going on. So when you see them in the limo together, they're both in the front seat, but there is a passenger in the back.
Oh, it's the teddy bear.
It's a stuffed teddy bear.
Apparently, that bear, that exact bear, makes an appearance in Hunt for Red October.
Nice.
Yeah, at the end of it. I've never seen Hunt for Red October. There's lots of movies I haven't seen.
That's okay.
You notice a lot of them are action films. Okay, but then Argyle starts asking him all these expositional questions. Exposition, exposition, exposition. That's for you, Drake. Exposition. You see when I say it too much.
We find out that McLean and his wife have been separated for 6 months, and McLean has been in New York while Holly's been taking this job out here.
You were just expecting her thing to dry up and for her to come back to you. No reason to pack, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You're very quick, Argyle.
Well, he had to be. He was a taxi driver.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people are probably dumping problems on him.
Mm-hmm. Let's pull up to Nakatomi Tower.
Sorry.
Well, there is a quick exchange where Argyle, being the super chill dude he is, he's like, look, I'll be here. If you need a ride home or a ride to your hotel, I'm just gonna hang out with my fully stocked bar and awesome party wagon in the garage.
Right. Which, I mean, honestly, Nakatomi Tower. I mean, if he's getting a limo, do you think John McLean hired that limo? Or do you think it was something that Holly got probably through her business?
I was wondering who got him the freaking taxi the limo, because...
Yeah, it says to me, like, maybe it's one of those things where she's like, hey, let's go ahead and get a limo for my husband. Because, I mean, she is like, she's played up later in like the next scene as being like incredibly important with the company.
Yeah, we find out she's number two later on.
Mm-hmm. She's like right underneath the boss.
She's number two because she's the shit.
These are the jokes.
John McLean enters the lobby. He approaches the security desk. And ladies and gentlemen, 1988, there's a touchscreen. Science!
I feel like I should have better responses, but I'm not coming up with anything. I'm sorry. Like, maybe just pause it. Just let it pause. Let it sit in. There was a touchscreen back in the 1980s. Science fiction then. Today, it's science fact.
Hey, are you going to buy those, you gonna buy those tampons? I'd like you to use my touchscreen and put in your personal phone number so that I can track your data.
is that what your side gig?
My side gig is skewing corporate data by buying tampons at various places throughout the month. I should have picked something other than tampons.
Google's like, oh, she's having a very heavy month.
All month, every month, she's bought 17 packages of tampons. But every time she enters her personal home phone number.
Which is really odd, because you wouldn't necessarily need 17 boxes. 17 boxes would, like, last you more than a year.
I mean, you'd hope so. But also, as long as we're talking about responsible giving, you know what homeless shelters can use a lot of? Ladies' products.
Mm-hmm.
Those aren't covered by food stamps. You can't just get them easily. Pads. Tampons.
Those aren't covered by food stamps. I think we need to change something.
I know that it's not food.
No, I get it. But it is
a personal necessity.
It is a necessity. I mean, if maybe more lawmakers were women, they would actually realize that.
Mm,
just saying.
Maybe.
Shade.
John McLean is on your side.
Yeah, he is.
John McLean, he cares.
He does.
Yeah, because he knows a little bit about bleeding out. That's foreshadowing.
Yeah, da 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 da.
God. So guys, applauders, Jonathan picks the bumper at the front of the show. We call it Jonathan's favorite moment. And so, like, neither I nor Lydia has any dictatorship over this. Like, Jonathan just, he's forced to listen to us for so long that he picks out the funniest thing and he puts it at the front of the episode. We don't know what that is until he is near or already published the episode. So, like, every time I say something so cringeworthy, I want to die a little bit, I have to think, is he going to think that's funny and leave it in? Or is he going to think that's awful and cut it out? Or is he going to think it's so awfully funny that he's going to put it at the front of the episode and then I'm going to have to hear myself? I can't not overthink it. We were talking about a touchscreen and how he had to find his wife's name and he looked it up under McLean, but she changed it.
She changed it. So now it's under her maiden name. Gennaro?
Gennaro.
I don't know. That sounds like a character from Jurassic Park. Like the lawyer.
She only really says it out loud twice. Mm-hmm. And that's just to like prove, you know, when she decides not to use it.
Alan Rickman uses it.
Oh, then I should have remembered it more. But mostly I just stare at his mouth while he talks.
That's okay.
Okay. Page 2 of my notes.
Okay, so McLean goes to the 30th floor, runs into Holly's boss as he's trying to look for his wife.
While he's walking over to finding the boss and all that business, he's offered a glass of champagne. Did you notice? It's a little plastic cup. He takes a drink. He says it's gross with his face. And then Willis sets it down again on some... He calls over another waiter and sets it down.
Yeah.
It is some fruit punch looking champagne.
Yeah.
I've seen polite pink champagne. I've seen golden and glorious, clear and rebellious. I have not seen like kids Kool-Aid looking champagne before. And I found that worthy of note. But now the boss is catching McLean up with his wife.
Yeah, telling John just how great Holly is and everything. And then they go into her office where she is not there, but we do meet her coworker, Cokehead Harry. Because he's doing coke on her desk. On her desk. Not his desk. Her desk.
He's in charge of like foreign relations sort of stuff, if I'm recalling right. Like foreign sales or something. Then he's got to have an office.
Yeah, he does have an office. In fact, his office has an attached bathroom because Holly points it out she takes him to a bathroom. It may not be his bathroom, but she does say that she had an eye out for his personal bathroom.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
So even though she's like right underneath the boss, he has the better office.
He's trying to like play off the fact that he's just snorted drugs off of his boss's desk. And now his boss's husband, who is a cop, is in there. And McLean's like, you missed something. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sorry, my Batman voice is also my Bruce Willis voice. But he's like wiping the coke off his nose. And he's like, he's trying to cover himself. He's like, show him that watch you got. Show them that watch you got.
Because Holly comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah, she comes in. And there's like this tense moment because you can see that McLean, being a cop, has just seen someone do illegal drugs. And then they try and like pass it off as soon as Holly comes in. And, you know.
It's 88. He's not trying to shake the boat, you know. And they cut to a picture of the moving truck coming.
Mm-hmm. Ominous music. Yeah. I wonder what that could be.
I don't even know. But what I will tell you is the next thing in my notes is young Bruce Willis in a white tank top. Aight. Because now he's like in their half bath area. He's using... Oh, she does have like a bathroom with a door. And
yeah, it's like a company bathroom, like a bathroom in the hallway that leads to...
I think it's in her room because she's sitting on her desk. She's kind of like leaning on her desk and he's like got this glass door open and he's like leaning around the thing. Yeah, it is a bathroom. There's a sink. There is a shirtless Bruce Willis. We don't really have to debate the geography out of it. It's fine.
But they do start getting into an argument because he brings up the fact that she's using her maiden name.
Well, they seem like they're going for an easy reconciliation, but then like immediately turns. Like they're mm-hmm. getting on with their niceties, which is kind of, they've been separated so long that they've got this visage of everything's all right. But then you see how quickly it crumbles when they have to talk about how it's not really working. Like if it was ideal and they had the same set of what this working looked like, they would be together.
Right.
But they both have different goals right now.
Right in the middle of their fight, Holly's secretary comes in. She's pregnant and asks to pull Holly aside so she can make a speech. And when Holly leaves, you can see John is like really like frustrated at how he handled it.
Yeah. He's like, great job.
Yeah.
This leads to him trying to center himself with the coping techniques taught to him by that rando on the plane.
And we do see that ominous van coming up mm-hmm. with the ominous music and a car kind of joining and like running alongside it. And what this is the car goes to the front, the van goes down into the garage, and the car...
Just to be clear, it's like a moving truck. It's not just like a...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not like a pickup.
No.
It's like a big old moving truck. And the car goes to the front, and two guys step out, and...
They enter the building talking like they're talking about a game. And the gentleman who we will eventually come to know as Theo is this young, attractive, bespectacled African-American man who is just running... Like, his smack-talking game, like, is real good, but the thing that struck me real hard as a person who's a fan of The Good Place is he looks so much like the character Chidi that I'm already in love with him, and I can't say otherwise because he's just like so, like, if somebody's smart and like knows what they want and they're just like on point, pivot, like he does that the entire film until the last time we see him, so I'm like already like I want him in every scene,
yes,
every reaction shot, give it all to me, Chidi, except now I know his name is Theo.
They take out the receptionist, and Theo comes in.
Ooh, who was our first dead guy?
Oh yeah. Ding. But they the guy who took out the receptionist goes around to the other corner, kind of like he already knows where there's another security guard. Theo comes up and he's like, you know, hack in the building because he is the hacker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we see the van pull up, go over to like a landing area, and it like opens up, and you see this gaggle of guys coming out, and who is at the center of it? But Alan Rickman.
Oh, Alan, thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it.
Well, Hans, good to see you. I also have entitled this part of the film, The Plans Are Laid Montage.
Mm-hmm. I grabbed like a pillow halfway through this movie so that way I could just hold it for certain moments. Sorry.
No, that's perfect. I was like, what happened was I would put down my notebook and I'd stare at the film and then I'd grab it up and I'd scribble really fast and then I'd set it down again.
I had like at least three moments where I paused it and it was right on a scene where there was Alan Rickman, and he was just like, in one moment, his eyes were closed, his mouth was just a little bit parted.
I mean, if you ever want to make a case for cloning.
Yeah.
Okay. So the phone lines have been cut. Do you want to say anything about the lines being cut moment between the two individuals? I think that's right then.
You know, there's a call between John and Argyle, and is John about to say, like, it still hasn't been figured out, so don't go anywhere just yet? That's the kind of conversation.
Yes, they're on the phone when the phone lines are being cut.
Right. And one of the guys, one of the bad guys.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is 1988. I'm going to say that 8 more times. There's a phone in the limo,
mm-hmm.
which is not usual. See, what happened was there was a time when we did not have cell phones, guys. We didn't have them, and we had to use the car phones and landlines to communicate. It was a sneeze after Morse code. So anyways, the line... Oh, okay, so what happens with a home phone is that there's a wire that would go from the phone to the ground, and you could actually physically cut that wire.
And then you wouldn't be able to call out. And that's what happens. They cut the line on the phone, and the call between McClane and Argyle gets cut off because they cut the line.
And Argyle is so chill. He's like, I guess he had stuff to do. I better hang out in this garage.
He does not question it at all.
Nope. He's hanging out with that stuffed bear that McClane brought for his children.
He's probably on, you know, someone else's dime at this point. I think at one point he pulls out some liquor.
The only time I think you see him drinking is right before he stops drinking. But who's to say? There's a lot of downtime where you don't get to hang out with Argyle, which is one of my main complaints about the film. So we are now 18 minutes into the film when there is gunfire.
Boom, 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 boom. And John hears this and he looks outside without his shoes on, by the way.
He's taking them off to wiggle into the carpet, but now he's got other priorities.
Right, because he still has his gun, which was established at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks out and he sees that, you know, all of the people are getting, you know, hustled in the same area. And he makes a break for an exit.
Yep. I entitled this portion of my notes, gunfire, bathroom hiding, and boobs. There's it's probably less than 3 seconds of a then popular Playboy bunny. She was caught in flagrante.
But it's actually kind of important because there's like one of the guys is about to come to the bathroom door, and McClane ends up like making his escape because that guy is distracted by boobies.
I mean, that works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want that more as a plot device and other things I've seen. I mean, it worked. And I know this is a weird callback, a weird flex, if you will, but it worked in the Xanth novels. Like if you needed to distract a male character, a female character could just show one of her sets of lady bits, and they would be paralyzed for a short period of time, and you can make your escape.
Somehow that sounds really familiar. Like, I think I might have... Was there ever a show that was created off of those novels?
Not to my knowledge. But if there is a Plotters, I need it.
I mean, could you... I mean, like, let's name a movie where that wouldn't work. I think it would be easier to name a movie where that would work.
Batman Returns.
I would not turn that down. Could you imagine? I don't know about you, Titty, but I feel so much...
It's like their superpower.
Oh man,
I was gonna go somewhere way weirder than that. I was gonna be like Muppets Take Manhattan or something. I'm so sorry. We're gonna get there, guys.
Hey guys, Alan Rickman's back.
But are you? You've now heard "Ode to Joy" twice by this part of the film
because they're in the elevator. Mm-hmm. And when I first saw that scene, I was like, they're in an elevator. Alan Rickman's doing elevator music. I didn't realize it was "Ode to Joy."
Oh, yeah.
And then when I watched it on my second viewing, I was like, oh, okay, I'm gonna scratch that out and try and like sound smarter than I really am.
He's just like, oh, your suit. That's nice. I have two of them.
Yeah.
So, anyways, we enter the conference room where Hans Sexbot. MacGruber.
I think MacGruber.
Hans MacGruber. MacGruber is a really bad film for a couple of years ago, which I have not also seen. So let's be fair.
I know it was based off of an SNL skit. That's all I know about it.
I'm not going to pass judgment. We are now in the conference room. We are now getting the objective of our villains.
Mm-hmm. It's obvious that he's like, oh, look at this. This is really they go through all of these different models, and then when they come to the main conference room area, that's when Takagi, he goes ahead and is like, you're not terrorists, because all this guy wants is just the money that's in their vault.
But we learn the plot twist that they're trying to present themselves as terrorists.
Yeah. Though they never actually like use that word. There's a lot of their actions. What is it? Like when they first get the hostages together.
Alan Rickman pulls out his little leather book with so many pages.
Mm-hmm.
Just so many pages.
Yeah. And he just starts talking about how they're going to see the fruits of their labor, which is kind of like this ominous, like cultish thing, you know?
Yeah. They're like, this company has something so important that I don't pay attention to big speeches, something that we will bring them to their knees about something. My mind went blank as I stared at Hans Gruber. Giant notebook.
Yes.
So he's flipped all the way. Okay, so we're in the conference room. Let's go back. They walk past a Frank Lloyd Wright model of a bridge.
Looks amazing.
Nephew said, it looks like a spaceship. I said, that's a bridge from 1949 that never got made in the bay. He's like, it would be a better spaceship. I think Frank Lloyd Wright would approve.
Yes. Yes, I do.
I think he'd be down.
Mm-hmm.
While they're having the discussion about the fact that Gruber's really about the money in the vault in the building,
mm-hmm.
Bruce Willis does a very nice floor crawl.
Yeah, yeah. Gets underneath a table.
No shoes, tank top.
Yeah.
The little shimmy.
And when Takagi refuses to give up he says he doesn't know the code to the vault.
Even if I told you, they would change it in the Japanese section of the business. Like, they're going to change it. Like, me giving you the word doesn't do anything.
But didn't he say, like, he was at this point thinking that they were wanting information. He didn't realize that they were wanting, like, the money in the vault.
Probably.
And so he was like, any information you get, it's going to get changed tomorrow in the morning in Japan. And he was like, he wasn't interested in the information. He was interested in the bonds that are worth like $640 million.
Yeah, whatever. I think it's $140 million in Bayer bonds.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also art and .. in mysterious vault. And then Hans gives him, he's like, tell me in the count of three, there will be no four. Which me and Lydia, like, I didn't do it like alone, but when he said that, Lydia and I are just like, nor shall you count to two unless it is followed by three. You shall not count to four. And five
is right out. We both went to Monty Python and the Quest for Holy Grail.
The holy hand grenade is like one of the best bits I've ever seen in my entire life.
Oh, I know.
And it was out well before this, so what if that was the thing? Little British Alan Rickman being like, five is right out.
What was it? It was that whole exchange is just amazing. But I do like how both of us kind of went to this whole, like, you know, Monty Python sketch.
Yep. Wouldn't do without it. So anyways, he says, count to three.
Boom.
Dead guy number three.
Yeah. And so that's when the shot goes off. That's when McClane, like, bumps his head on the table.
Hides in a bathroom.
Makes himself known, but still hides himself in a bathroom. What did you say about the door?
Okay, so everybody starts skittering around the room, like, checking all the doors, right? And this long-haired blonde guy, whose name I will never remember, he checks the door and it opens it. He looks inside, nothing. He gets to a locked bathroom door, shakes the handle, and turns around and is like, okay. And isn't like, hey, boss, there's this locked door right here.
Maybe we should go through this locked door, or maybe I should just go ahead and start firing my gun.
Well, if he'd gotten into that door, right? Because it's not like they care about the property at all. If he just kicked down that door a little bit, we could have cut to Alan Rickman on a beach for the next hour and 45 minutes, Lydia.
That would be wonderful.
I'm just saying.
I mean, he wouldn't be in the suit. But he wouldn't he wouldn't be in the suit. But on the other side of that coin, he wouldn't be in the suit.
I think he'd still have the tie.
Gotta commit to it.
So let's cut to the plan breakdown with Chidi. I mean, Theo.
So they, do you want me to do that?
Do you know the breakdown? Because I just know that there are six locks they gotta get through, and then they get to the final shiny door.
They go, yeah, it's like the six that Theo can go ahead and get through. At one point, Han says, are you sure you can do it? And Theo's like, well, you didn't bring me along for my shining personality. But really, you could have, because Theo is really energetic. I like that he's a bit of a computer geek, but he's also a geek about football because he makes all of these different football references.
Oh, because I did not catch a single one of those. Mm-hmm. What I do notice is that he's different from the group. You can tell that he's kind of like a hired hand. He's not like, he's not interested in these German guys he's hanging out with. He's here for a payday. He may be interested in a big score because it's like a feather for him, but he's not going to hang out with these guys afterwards. Like, I could imagine them drinking fancy drinks on a beach, but I see him somewhere way different.
Right, right. He's not going to be with them hanging out. But I do want to point out that this was one of those moments where I was like, oh, Hans is making bedroom eyes at the vault. I want to be that vault,
yes,
right now.
I wrote down the final door is big and shiny, and then my smiley face is like a smiley face with a heart for the mouth. Because yeah. I too want a giant shiny door to hold all of what I want behind it. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
I was watching a show today. They had a secret entrance where they like pulled a thing and the thing swung out.
Oh,
and I was
yeah.
I used to clean for a guy who had a bookshelf that swung out. And I had to vacuum his secret little room. And I was like, it's just the greatest thing I've ever done.
It is. What was the book that you had to pull? Or was it not like a book?
No, it was just a bookshelf. You just pulled the edge.
Oh, cool.
They didn't hide it well.
No.
But when I take over that house in the zombie apocalypse, I'll hide it well.
Good, good.
That is super on the whatever.
He's like, hey, I know who this Naomi chick is.
Oh, no. I haven't been there since Jonathan and I first got married. So we're talking okay. Like 12 or 13 years ago, I haven't been at this person's house. So if I showed up and I was just like, hey, you got a room I like, so I'm taking your house. That's the worst zombie apocalypse plan ever.
I was just thinking maybe he, you know, still remembers you because you're very memorable. Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing. That's a compliment. But he's like, hey, she's doing this podcast. Oh, so if the zombie apocalypse breaks out, or maybe he just doesn't live there anymore, and then it's going to be someone completely different.
All right. Well, my next note skips a bunch, I'm pretty sure, and is the quote,
what floor did the fire alarm originate?
So McClane goes ahead and he, you know, is kind of in this place where he's like, I got to do something. And he sees a sprinkler and sees a fire alarm. He pulls a fire alarm.
He has to look at the sprinkler and then he's like, oh, fire's happened. I could pull this alarm.
But he goes ahead and pulls it. And that's when, like, they see, oh, there's a fire alarm going off, which means that automatically the police or the fire department's going to show up.
This is only the beginning of our three-part descent through the towering blockbuster known as Die Hard, A Plotter. We're scheduling back-to-back weekly episodes all the way to Christmas Day. To recap the camp, give love to Gruber, and celebrate what truly brings us together this time of year, Bruce Willis in a tank top. Hey, this is your audio engineer and 2 weeks from retirement buddy, Jonathan. You might wonder how we went from Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth to the subversively sensational holiday blockbuster. Your guess is as good as mine. It's always Lady's Choice. But I will say that Pan's producer, Alfonso Cuarón, was recommended by Guillermo del Toro to direct Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, which starred none other than Alan Rickman. Speaking of name drops, Christine became our first official Patreon applauder this past Small Business Saturday. Way to go, Christine! After some site upgrades, you should now have access as a $5 per month applauder to high-quality unbleeped episodes, our blog archive, listener growth updates, and more. Want to be an applauder too? Search for us on Patreon or visit shoppedandapplaud.com for more details. We'll be back with part two of our review of Die Hard in only 1 week. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.